Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log.
Regular Soundcheck listeners might be getting confused about all the anniversaries we're marking this week. The 90th anniversary of our home station WNYC. We've also been doing the 20th anniversary of the summer of 94. Now let's throw in one of those Beatles-related anniversaries, because 1964, 50 years ago, was when the group landed on American soil and set off a cultural revolution as well as a musical one. And one prong in the band's total conquest of the U.S. that year was the film A Hard Day's Night. It was recently restored and re-released in theaters across the country in honor of its 50th anniversary. And to mark that occasion, I'm joined by Matt Zoller-Seitz, editor-in-chief of RogerEbert.com and a frequent contributor to New York Magazine. Matt, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me.
So, when did you first see this movie, Hard Day's Night?
Well, I think I first saw it when I went through my Beatles phase, which I think almost everybody goes through at some point. And I found my way to the Beatles through the Red and Blue albums, the compilations. That was a gateway drug for a lot of Beatles fans. And Hard Day's Night, I had no idea that the Beatles had movies until I started reading about them. And I started with Hard Day's Night, worked my way to Help, Yellow Submarine, mm-hmm. and so forth.
So for folks who haven't seen the film or haven't seen it in a while, the plot, such as it is.
Well, the plot is John, Paul, George, and Ringo play the Beatles. they are the Beatles, and they are having adventures. They're getting in wacky situations and having strange conversations and running away from their screaming fans and occasionally performing music and running and jumping and leaping about.
It's basically, you should pardon the expression, a day in the life of the Beatles.
That's one way of putting it. Yeah. Well, what it really was the United Artists conceived this movie as a kind of a glorified excuse to make money off of a soundtrack. Mm-hmm. They never really imagined that this was going to be anything other than a bit of exploitation. And in fact, the European head of United Artists said before the film came out, whatever money that we lose on distributing this movie, we'll make it back on the soundtrack. Well, to their shock, the film directed by Richard Lester was actually a good movie.
And 50 years later, you know, we're still talking about it, mostly, you know, in a kind of approving way, you know, as opposed to the condescension I expect that United Artists thought they were going to get.
Exactly. Well, in fact, it earned one critic called it the Citizen Kane of jukebox movies, which means that not only was it one of the first successful rock films that was recognized as a piece of legitimate popular art, but it also spawned a critical cliche that we use to this day.
Well, the film is A Hard Day's Night, directed by Richard Lester. It opened in England on July 6th of that summer 50 years ago, 1964. It opened here in the States on August 11th of that year. And, you know, this kind of send-up of the Beatles' fame at the height of Beatlemania, there's a good example of that. When a woman recognizes John Lennon in the hall, and they have this exchange.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, wait a minute. Don't
no, I'm not.
Oh, you are.
I'm not.
Oh, you are. I know you are.
I'm not, no.
You look just like him.
Do I? You're the first one that said that ever.
Yes, you do. Look.
No, my eyes are lighter. Okay. All right, Noddy.
Oh,
my nose.
Yes, your nose is very.
Is it?
Well, I would have said so.
Oh, you know him better, though.
I do not. He's only a casual acquaintance.
That's what you say.
What have you heard?
It's all over the place.
Is it really?
But I wouldn't have it. I stuck up for you.
I knew I could rely on you.
Thanks.
You don't look like him at all.
She looks more like him than I do.
That's still great.
This is 5 years before Monty Python, by the way.
It is, and in fact, listening to that, I'm reminded that the great influence on the Beatles as performers, as actors, is probably the Marx Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, when you look at them, you really do see a profound Marx Brothers influence, and that was apparent from the very first set of press conferences they did when they went for their first United States tour. These guys were real wits. They were natural on camera. They were very quick. This is a scripted film, but there's obviously a lot of stuff that was either developed out of improvisation or that was improvised, and it feels very loose, and it's got that spirit of not just the Marx Brothers, but also W.C. Fields, Laurel and Hardy, that kind of feeling.
Yeah, and a little Benny Hill as well. I mean,
yes.
You know, there's a couple of kind of sped-up sequences.
There are, and in fact, I think we should mention the director here, Richard Lester. Richard Lester is one of the great sort of unacknowledged influential directors of the last 50, 60 years, and Steven Soderbergh is such a big fan of his that he co-authored a book with him. Richard Lester did this film called The Running, Jumping, and Standing Still film, which, if as you can guess, even if you haven't seen it, you can guess from the title why he was the right choice for Hard Day's Night, because it has a lot of running and jumping and standing still. But the way that he edited it was really, to use that word, jukebox again, it just had a jukebox feeling. It had a kind of a, what we would call now a music video feeling, discontinuous editing.
Lots of jump cuts,
but also a celebration of movement, And there's a wonderful quote from Roger Ebert's review of the movie where he says, "The most powerful quality evoked by A Hard Day's Night is liberation." And, of course, it's a harbinger of the sort of cultural liberation that would flower in the late 60s, but also a cinematic and artistic liberation of from some of the constraints of commercial storytelling, that we can make this into a very light, fluffy piece of art.
And liberation is the order of the day when the band, having been sort of caught in these claustrophobic confines, you know, the train station,
yes,
the TV studio, they finally break out.
They break out running. Well, and that's how the movie begins. The movie begins with that fantastic, you know, the opening chord of A Hard Day's Night, which is one of the great opening chords in the history of rock and roll. Everybody knows it. And bam, they're running.
Right.
They're running. And
they're running away.
They're running away.
But here in this scene, they're running to this kind of playing field.
Well, they are. They are. And they're leaping and they're jumping. And the camera's tilting in strange ways. And it's craning up to catch them as they're leaping over the camera. And they're cutting in ways that make them often seem as if they're flying, like they're defying gravity. Again, that idea of liberation.
And the music that they're running and cavorting to is this.
I don't care too much for money. Money can't buy me love. Can't buy me love. Everybody tells me so. Can't buy me love. No, 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 no. Say it on me, no diamond rings, and I'll be satisfied. Tell me that you want the kind of thing the money just can't buy.
Can't Buy Me Love from the Beatles. That is the music that they are running and jumping and apparently flying to in that scene sort of late in the movie.
Yes.
Hard Day's Night. We're speaking with Matt Zoller-Seitz, editor-in-chief of RogerEbert.com and contributor to New York Magazine, about A Hard Day's Night, directed by Richard Lester, and now playing once again at the Film Forum here in New York through July 17th. It's been restored and re-released on its 50th anniversary. So you're hearing that song,
yes,
while the band members are running around, but there are other parts of the movie where you hear Beatles songs, and they seemed, actually the famous scene on the train, where they have cards in their hands and then suddenly they have instruments.
Yes.
And so everything is synced, right? It's lip-synced and...
Yeah, everything is synced. I don't think there's a whole lot of live performance in the movie because it wouldn't work in terms of the editing if they shot it that way. But that said, there is a tremendous sense of fidelity to them as musicians. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like a lot of... I think about these, like... Frankie Avalon and Annette Funicello beach party films, and a lot of the Elvis movies where the people are dancing. They're not even dancing in time to the music. They've got people playing guitars who clearly don't know how to play the guitar, or they're just not bothering, and it's not that kind of a case. You get the sense that these guys really are musicians, that it's, and you know, of course they are in real life, but movies don't often respect the fidelity of what they do.
But some of these songs, I mean, Can't Buy Me Love had been released earlier in the year, so... You know, when United Artists said, whatever we lose on the movie, we'll make back on the music, they had a kind of a sure thing in their pocket already.
They did. They did. I mean, the Beatles, this was the point in the Beatles' lives where everything they touched turned to gold. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just absurd. And you can see, I mean, you know, there's entire books that have been written about. There's a whole book I have on my shelf that's just a, it's just a list of everything the Beatles did day by day, every day that they were together. And they were the most overscheduled four guys in the history of civilization, probably. Like, only heads of state were as busy as these guys, and they were shooting movies, they were recording albums, and you know, this is maybe or maybe not germane to this film. Maybe it is, because they are running and jumping a lot, and they just seem like they're on fast forward the whole time. But when you look at the fact that they were together for such a brief period of time, and the fact that they made all these films, all these albums, all these singles, they went on tour, and they found time to cultivate individual careers as solo artists that would flower in the 70s, I just can't even fathom how they were able to do everything that they did and have it be good. This movie is good.
That is the thing. How much of a surprise was this? How different is this from all the other music films of the 50s and 60s?
It's enormously influential, particularly for the, again, and the two go hand in hand, the use of music, the use of pop music, and the editing. And they really go together. And what is particularly interesting about it is that it's a kind of a beginning of, again, to invoke Roger Ebert, the semi-obligatory musical interlude, as he calls it, where the film proper almost comes to a halt, and you have this wonderful little enclosed space, almost a dreamlike space. And old movies used to do that, but the segue was a little more graceful. Like, that reminds me of a time last summer when, and then they'll sing a song about the summer.
Right.
And here it's just, bam, suddenly we're into music land, and geography means nothing, time and space mean nothing, and it's just pure movement.
There's also a scene which is a send-up. I mean, you mentioned all the things the Beatles did. They had to make time for the press.
They did.
For meeting the media. And this scene is a send-up of one of the Beatles' press conferences.
Tell me, how did you find America?
Turn left to Greenland.
Has success changed your life?
Yes.
I'd like to keep Britain tidy.
Are you a mod or a rocker?
No, I'm a mocker.
Have you any hobbies?
No, actually, we're just good friends.
Do you think these haircuts have come to stay?
Well, this one has, you know. Stuck on good and proper now.
Frankly nice.
What would you call that hairstyle you're wearing?
Arthur.
No, actually, we're just good friends.
You're the brown, aren't they?
What do you call that collar?
A collar.
Oh,
do you often see your father?
No, actually, we're just good friends.
How do you like your girlfriends to dress?
That's a little bit more from A Hard Day's Night. You know, it must have been hard. I mean, I've grown up, and I'm sure, Matt, you have too, with, you know, Monty Python and BBC America and stuff, and we're used to the British accents. For audiences in the 60s, like, the funny line, what do you call that haircut? Yeah. Arthur. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people miss that.
Yes, I'm a mocker.
Mocker. I love
that. That's my favorite line in the entire movie. And the it's the very slight pause that really makes it. But yeah, it's funny you should mention the accents, because right before the film was released, there were some concerns. An executive at United Artists asked them to perhaps consider redubbing the entire movie. John, Paul, George, and Ringo's voices with, quote, mid-Atlantic accents. Like, in other words, something that was not quite so Liverpoolian. And McCartney supposedly was the one who put the kibosh on that, and he said, if they can understand, and, you know, I'm going to have to leave a word out, but he said, if we can understand freaking John Wayne in England, they can understand Liverpool in the United States. Mm-hmm. And they just said no.
And they turned out, again, to be right.
I know, they were right quite a bit, weren't they?
A Hard Day's Night, now 50 years old, restored, re-released, playing at Film Forum through July 17th. We've been speaking with Matt Zoller-Seitz, editor-in-chief at RogerEbert.com, about this great old Beatles classic. Matt, good to talk to you today.
Thank you very much.
Tell me why you cried and why you lied to me. Tell me why you cried and why you lied to me.
Thanks for listening. Stay connected by subscribing to the Soundcheck podcast on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and download the new WNYC mobile app for free. See you next time. I'm John Schaefer.